The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Sports Talk 1240 is brought to you by DraftPot.com. DraftPot is changing fantasy sports. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with promo code SportsTalk1240 and receive a 100% deposit bonus up to $1,500. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
All right, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through this first hour on Sunday night, the first day of November. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in former New York Mets left-handed pitcher from the 1973 Mets, John Matlack, will join us. In the second half, we'll talk to the former All-Pro wide receiver from the New York Jets, Wesley Walker. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on WGBB. We've got some great stuff ahead for you in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at SportsTalk1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest was one of the big three pitchers in the New York Mets were built around in the 1970s, along with Tom Seaver and Jerry Kuzman. He was a three-time All-Star and Rookie of the Year in the National League in 1972. I'd like to welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, John Matlack. John, good evening.
Good evening, Bill. How are you?
Great. It's great to have you with us on this eve of World Series game number five.
Yeah, it's a big one tonight, no doubt about it.
Yeah, and it's to do or die for the Mets, so we want to wish them well. Now, John, you debuted with the Mets in the second game of a doubleheader on July 11, 71. It was against the Cincinnati Reds. Do you recall that game at all?
I do a little bit. The clubhouse guy wanted to send me a bill for the carpet. He said I wore it out by all the pacing I was doing during the first game.
Amazing. Yeah, well, you pitched seven innings. You left the game with a 3-2 lead. However, two guys named Tug McGraw and Tom Seaver were unable to close the door. Now, Seaver came in that game as a reliever?
Yeah, it was right in front of the All-Star break, and he wasn't going to get another start, and it was an opportunity to use him, and I was singing in the shower because I had Seaver for a caddy and had the lead. I thought I had it locked up, but it didn't work that way.
Imagine that. Yeah, now, Tony Perez did some damage in that game. I looked up and did a little homework. He hit a solo home run off you, and then he touched up Seaver for a three-run job.
Yes, sir. He got me early on an opposite field on a backdoor curveball that I put in the wrong place, and then later got Tommy and the one that he pulled that was the game maker for them.
Yeah, he did a lot of damage to the Mets, Tony Perez, in his day. That's why he's in the Hall of Fame. Now, a couple of guys I'd like to talk to you about. Let's get your impression on Mr. Seaver right now.
Oh, Tommy was great. I couldn't have been in a better spot when they stuck me in that locker room. My locker was dead between Tom Seaver and Jerry Kuzman. And, you know, I got left-handed advice on the one side from a guy who'd been down the big league road already, and then I got a lot of theory and help along the way from Tom, who kept me from getting too far off of center as a young guy trying to get his feet wet in the big leagues. It was a great spot to be in. I got some good information.
Sure did, I bet. Now, when you first came up, John, we're speaking to John Matlack tonight, you worked for Gil Hodges.
Very briefly.
Yeah.
The time I was up in 71, the game you referred to, he was the manager there. And actually, I made the club in 72, and we had a brief strike. And I guess it was the day of or just the day before he had gone to play golf and had the heart attack and died on the golf course.
What a shame. Yeah, big loss for the New York Mets, big loss for baseball. And I believe he should be in the Hall of Fame.
I would not disagree with that for sure.
Now, for the season that year, John, you went 0-3 at a 4.14 ERA, six starts. But your last game, you had a great appearance. You gave up one run in eight innings of work against the Buccos.
Yep.
The game went 15 innings, and Danny Frisella got the win.
Well, that I couldn't have told you, but yeah, I knew I had a solid eight innings.
Yeah, guy, the late Danny Frisello, who was part of the great bullpen tandem with Tug McGraw back in those days,
yep.
He picked up the win. Now, you know, as you say, John, you made the team out of spring training in 72, and you got off to a 6-0 start.
It was a little strange because early on I was the fifth starter and wasn't needed due to scheduling and rainouts and whatnot. There were a lot of off days. So I was working out of the bullpen, picked up a win in relief following Gentry one day against the Cubs, and started after that and was able to win 4 or 5 in a row, ended up 6-0 with a 1-point-something or other. I was at the top of the New York Times sports section where they listed the,
yeah.
the pitchers. And I guess I didn't believe I belonged there because I proceeded to give back my next three games, and my ERA blossomed, and that's one of the times Seaver got a hold of me and said, look, if you don't own the success you have, you're doomed to give it back, and it was pretty sound advice.
Definitely. Great advice from Tom. Terrific. Now, you ended the season 15-10, 2.32 ERA, and you win the National League Rookie of the Year award.
Yeah, and, you know, in all reality, it was something I didn't even know existed. I guess I was just a youngster from the small town somewhere that didn't know a whole lot about the big league circumstance except for the competition. I didn't even really know about the award until sometime in August when people started questioning me about it.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty good. Now, on September 30th, let's talk about this day that a lot of people remember. You gave up Roberto Clemente's 3,000 hit. I remember it. I believe it was the final day of the season. His final career hit, and I remember reading somewhere Duffy Dyer saying he must have put down the wrong finger at that moment.
I don't know that with Clemente you put down the wrong finger. I think
yeah.
where you hope you're in a good spot and take your chances. He was a good bad ball hitter, and I was upset when the ball left my hand because I knew it wasn't going to be a strike. It was a breaking ball, and I was trying for the outside corner, and I knew from the feel of it that it was going to be away and probably low, and he always kept his hands back, and this was another time when he did just that and was able to reach out there and swat it into left center for a double.
Right. We all remember that. We remember Doug Harvey, another Hall of Famer, getting the ball and handing it to Roberto, and that unfortunately was the final hit of his career.
Yes, it was.
What a shame. Now, we'll move on to 73. Now, what a year that turned out to be. The Mets really weren't going anywhere. I remember the play that sort of turned things around, though, John. A guy named Dave Augustine, not exactly a household name, hits a drive to left field. You remember that?
I do. You hit right on the corner of the fence.
Amazing. Yeah, Cleon picks it up, not picks it up, but gets it on a pop off the top of the fence. And Richie Zist coming around from first base. I remember, I think it was Ron Hodges put the tag on him.
Yeah, he threw him out at the plate, and that was, for me, that was the turning point. And from that point forward, it seemed like everything we did came up roses, and it wasn't always the same guy. It was whatever the situation needed, somebody seemed to step up and fill the need, and we just played really solid baseball from that point forward.
You sure did. Now, before that, you had probably one of the lowlights of your career that I remember this vividly as well. A line drive off the bat of Marty Perez of the Atlanta Braves hit you in the forehead.
One of the worst headaches I've ever had.
I'm sure it was, man.
No, it was a strange situation. I thought I'd gotten him out the pitch before with a curveball that I thought he swung at. The umping crew decided he did not swing, and even on the appeal, you know, did not get the call. So I'm 3-2 with the bases loaded and trying to keep a lead with light rain falling, and I overthrew a fastball and I hit too hard, lost sight of the ball on its way to the plate. I can see him swing. I can hear the bat crack and, you know, hit the ball, but I don't pick it up until it's right on top of me, and there was no way to react, no time to react at that point. Got me on the forehead, sort of over the left eye.
And from what I read, John, it was quite an adventure getting to the hospital.
Oh, my Lord. It was a comedy of errors. First of all, they covered me up on the field with a tarp because it was raining to keep me dry. My wife is in the stands. She thinks I'm dead because I'm covered up.
Oh, man.
She's beating down the clubhouse door. they get that resolved. Then as I'm trying to get in the ambulance and get out of Shea, the ambulance driver can't find the way out of the parking lot, so I'm holding an ice bag on my head in the back of the ambulance, directing him out of the parking lot.
You might as well have taken the wheel.
It was really crazy. We get down to Manhattan, and there had been thunderstorms, and the ambulances are backed up, and they parked me in a hallway to decide what to do with me, and some guy who'd had too much to drink, who was on a higher gurney than mine, fell off of his on top of mine. I mean, it was just a comedy of errors all night.
Unbelievable. And then you finally make it home, and the press is waiting for you?
There was a press crew waiting for me in my driveway, and they were very disappointed that I didn't have visible damage to my face.
They wanted
to see a scar or a black eye or something like that. And somebody even suggested that I wear an eye patch to do an interview, which got a little upset about. And if I hadn't been holding my two-year-old daughter, I might have chased them out the driveway.
I don't blame you. Yeah, they were looking for blood, those characters.
Well, they were looking for something sensational, and unfortunately it wasn't there.
Yeah, exactly. Now, in 73, John, your record dipped 14 and 16. However, from August 18th on, you were 5-1, and the Mets captured the Eastern Division crown.
Yeah, like I said, that turning point against Pittsburgh, and we played well. Everybody sort of gelled at that point. I think if you look at the records, everybody in our division took their turn at first place at some point or another during the season. We just managed to take ours when it counted there at the end. And I can remember being extremely disappointed. I pitched a game in Chicago against Fergie and had a chance to clinch it. I gave up a run without a hit. I forget whether it was a walk, and the guy stole second and was moved over, scored on a ground ball, something like that. And an hour and 42 minutes later, Fergie beat me 1-0.
Another Hall of Famer.
Yep. So we did win it the next day, but I was very disappointed not to be in the spot to be able to clinch it.
Yeah, I can imagine, John. We're speaking to John Matlack tonight. Do you remember holding the Big Red Machine to two hits in Game 2 of the NLCS?
Vaguely.
Okay. do you remember who got the two hits off you? It was one guy.
Guy by the name of Andy Kosko.
Exactly.
A couple of ground balls between short and third.
Amazing. Now, people may remember Andy Kosko with the Dodgers, but certainly he was a bit role player for a while, first baseman for the Yankees.
Yeah, and I don't know, how or why they juggled the lineup the way they did that day. I just was extremely focused on one pitch at a time, one out at a time. Tommy had lost a very tough game the day before after striking out, 14 or 15 and giving up solo home runs to Bench and Rose. We lose 2-1, and I'm just fighting like the Dickens to try and scrap in there and give us a chance to win another one. And we did have a run early that put us up, but Rusty had something on Gullett, who was pitching for Cincinnati, and he told me, he said, "You keep him close because I'm going to get Gullett. He tips his pitches, and darned if he didn't hit a three-run homer about the eighth inning."
What a great ball player he was, certainly key in 73. Two guys I want to ask you about from the 73 club, John, Willie Mays.
Oh, Willie was great. That people talk about him being at the tail end of his career, but the knowledge and the instincts that he had and was able to convey through the way he used them and also from visiting with him was just great to have around the clubhouse and on the team. He was a phenomenal guy.
And how about the late, great skipper, Yogi Berra?
Also, another one of those you classify as good people. Yogi just, he gave us the bats and the balls and stayed out of our way and let us play the game. I almost wish there was more of that going on today. Yogi was good people, no question.
Certainly was. Now, you were equally impressive in the 73 series. Of course, the Mets take on the Oakland A's. Game one, I believe you started, John, gave up three hits in six innings.
Yeah, and it was unfortunate that one of those three was to the opposing pitcher and scored runs that ended up beating us. There had been an error made by the normally very steady and reliable Felix Mian.
Right, Felix.
I was unable to get past the pitcher. He squirted a ball between the bag and Wayne Garrett at third that ended up producing a couple of runs, and that made the difference, unfortunately, in the ball game.
Now, you won game four. You gave up one run, five hits, and eight innings. That was a superb effort.
and it was a very cold night. I thank my lucky stars for growing up in the Northeast on that evening because it was a cold night.
And you lost the seventh, the last game, the decisive game of the series, which was a heartbreaker, 5-2. In the third inning of that game, you gave up two-run home runs to Campy and Reggie Jackson. Not too shabby of hitters there, though.
No, they weren't. And in all reality, the ball that Campy hit was a good pitch. I think it might have been a little wind-aided because of the conditions on that day. Hit it opposite field. It was a breaking ball. And the one to Reggie, I mean, when it came out of my hand, I knew it was trouble because it was in the wrong spot. And most people would have hit it, and he certainly did. One good pitch that somebody was equal to the task, and, mm-hmm. and one that the good hitters crushed the mistakes, and I made a mistake, and Reggie crushed it, no question.
Much like he crushed three mistakes in the series with the Yankees in a row that time. We're speaking to John Matlack tonight on Sports Talk 1240. How did you feel, John? I have to ask you this about Yogi's decision to start Seaver in Game 6 on short rest instead of George Stone.
You know, I never gave it much thought at the time, and there's been a lot of discussion about it since, and really hindsight can be whatever you want it to be, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But we were trying to put our best foot forward, and Yogi was, in charge of the show and making the decisions. I never really gave it another thought. There was actually a lot of us at the tail end there that did a little work on short rest. It was not uncommon back in those days.
Right.
To do some of that during the course of the season. And so it wasn't out of the ordinary or something that strange. I think the only thing strange was that Stoney had such a solid season with a good record and that, that got bypassed for Tommy. But then Tom was Tom. He was our number one.
Why not go with what got you there?
Yep.
Yogi, I know, took a lot of heat for that. But as you say, John, hindsight's 20/20. Now, you were an all-star the next 3 years for the Mets, so you had a pretty stellar career there, and even shared MVP honors in the 75 games with Bill Madlock. You get tired of getting called Madlock and Matlack,
we're very sort of convinced that the reason that it was the only time, I guess, there's been co-MVPs was because they couldn't tell the names apart. Because as we're going back to the locker room after the game, it's sort of a long hike up a set of stairs there in old Milwaukee Stadium, and you can hear somebody hollering Madlock, and I'm telling Bill, hey, they're calling for you, Bill. He said, no, they're saying Madlock. And by the time it's all said and done, somebody had to come up and get both of us and bring us back down to the field.
He was some heck of a hitter, that Madlock.
No question.
The Mad Dog. Now, in 76, you have a great year. You go 17-10 with a 2.95 ERA, 6 shutouts. You finish 6th in the Cy Young voting. Not too bad a year.
No, it was a good year. I was finding my stride a little bit and figuring out a way to win ball games. Sometimes it wasn't all on your shoulders. You might do your job, and somewhere along the line there wasn't enough runs put on the board to get the win, but my job was to keep us in the ball game as long as I was out there, and in to me was, ahead one or two, behind one or two, tie, somewhere in that bracket that gave us a chance to win was what I was trying to accomplish.
Sure, and as you say, John, sometimes never enough runs. You played for the light-hitting Mets team during those eras. The Mets always known for pitching, not so much for hitting. I always agree with the premise. Guys like you, certainly Tom Seaver would have had more wins if they played for a little bit more offensive-minded ball club. You ever think of that?
Well, I didn't at the time. It's been brought to my attention post-career that, some of the stretches, and one of them that is sort of interesting, and I can recall because I recently talked to somebody about it, was a 54-inning stretch in the 72 season when I didn't get a win, and I only allowed 4 runs total.
Hmm.
So there were numerous no decisions and a couple of 1-0 losses, but there was a lot of quality pitching right there that produced no W's, gave us a chance to win. We just didn't. And, in retrospect, was it bad luck? I don't know. Was I upset about it? No, because my job was to keep us in the ball game while I was out there, and that's what I had done, so I felt good about that.
Sure. Now, the trade to Texas, did you see that coming?
No, not really. You know, there was some attempt at making it sound like I wanted to be traded. It was not the case. There was a dismantling of the club. I think if you want to look at it that way, over a period of a year, Tommy went in June of 77. I went in December of 77. Cousy went in June or so of 78. So within a year, the big three was no longer there.
Dismantled, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, why, I have no idea. I did make a few statements in the press, mostly to try and exhibit a desire to have, you know, a better effort made to put a more quality product on the field. Let's do something to improve what we've got. And apparently that was thought to be somebody who was disgruntled and wanted to be traded, I guess.
Yeah. Who was the GM at that time? Joe McDonald?
Joe McDonald, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Torrey was the manager, and his first stint at managing, and Joe D was the GM.
Right. Now, in Texas, in 78, you went 15-13, 2.27 ERA, which is second to the Gator, Ron Guidry, that year.
Yeah, we had quite a few battles. We locked up opening day. I was able to win that one. He did not lose it. Gossage got beat, but there were a couple of times that we went head-to-head, and then when you look back at the records, it was the stats were pretty close, too.
Yeah, most definitely. Now, in 79, you had elbow surgery, a little trouble with the elbow, but you rebound in 80 to make 34 starts for Texas. And in one of the games on August 19th, you go against the Royals down at Arlington, and you halt George Brett's, I believe he had a 30-game hitting streak, and you stopped him.
Yeah, it was 30 or 31, I think, somewhere in there. And it was something that, I don't know, that you set out to try and do it, but if the circumstances in the game were such that I could do it, I was going to try and do things that were atypical of what I would normally do with George Brett and see if I couldn't do something about stopping the streak, and what I mean by that is just doing things out of character for me, sequentially or location-wise with pitches that he might find a little bit unusual and hopefully surprising.
Yeah, well, tough to pitch to that man anyway. You keep up with the Mets these days, John?
I do somewhat, and you know, I'm obviously watching the series, and I have checked on the. On the computer and see who's doing what and follow guys that I have come across in my coaching career, which I did for quite a number of years after playing. And so, yeah, I do follow them to some degree.
Do you find anybody giving you a comparison to Steven Matz?
I have heard that mentioned from time to time, and I'm tickled that they gave my old number to somebody who has good stuff and is left-handed, so I'm pleased with that.
Not too bad. What do you think of that staff as a whole, John?
I think it's a very quality staff. There's no doubt about it. There's a really large amount of good stuff, and I think as they get a little older, and some of them a little older and a little more maturity, it's going to only get better.
Yeah, I can recall what Smoltz said about them, that they're better than the Braves staff at this point in their career.
I think he could be right. It's hard to say. You don't know what is going to come down the pike, trades or injuries or any of that stuff, God forbid. But certainly with experience, they all have enough raw talent that it could be quite a staff.
I remember saying to Greg Maddux, they're not in the Hall of Fame, though, like you guys. And he says, we weren't in the Hall of Fame at that point in our careers either. So
No. And
he shut me up.
There's a whole lot of ball to be played before that happens, no doubt.
Definitely. And what are you up to these days, John?
I am a retired character in upstate New York. I live in the Adirondack Mountains. And
nice.
Not doing a whole lot of anything right at the moment.
Yeah, you were a pitching coach for a while, though.
Yeah, I was stationary pitching coach for a number of years and became a pitching coordinator for 16 years with the Detroit Tigers, and then another year with Houston, and that sort of ended it. Houston club got sold, and personnel changed there, and the new GM changed, I don't know, 70 or 80 jobs, and I was one of them. And that was sort of the end of my coaching, so I have been out except for some minor things. I've helped out some of the guys that I've come across over the years that have called with an issue here or there and, you know, little things like that, but that's been it.
You looking to get back, John, or you think you're just going to kick back for a while?
I wouldn't mind getting back, but the game has gone so far in the direction of analytics, and to me...
Yeah, you're right.
That's a little bit disgruntling. Also, the real strict adherence to pitch counts and whatnot, I don't think it's a bad thing for everybody, but I think there's some guys out there that you're inhibiting their ability to grow and become what they could be by placing these restrictions on them. And some of that is bothersome. And of course, if you voice that in the wrong company, you put yourself in trouble. So
right.
there might not be a circumstance for me to coach in today's game.
I hear you. Well, you guys certainly didn't have pitch counts. Seaver, Kuzmin, Matlack, Tug McGraw used to go 3-4 innings in relief. I can see your point definitely there with the pitch counts.
Well, it's just the way the game has changed.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's, like I say, I don't know that it's good or bad. I just think that taking the game away from the guys on the field in large respect, and not every club does it, but certainly a lot of them do, changes their ability to grow and learn from the game itself. If somebody's telling you what to do, you get no credit if it's right, and you don't have to accept any blame if it's wrong.
Certainly. Well, John, I tell you, it's been a real pleasure having you with us tonight, talking some Mets and talking about your great career. I thank you for taking the time out of your Sunday evening to be with us, and let's go Mets tonight.
Absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity, and now we'll go turn on the game and see how they're doing.
There you go. Have a good night, John. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Bill.
John Matlack, ladies and gentlemen. Well, next up, we'll talk to the former Jets great wide receiver, Pro Bowler, Wesley Walker on Sports Talk 1240. Stay with us, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPot has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit up to $1,500. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit up to $1,500. What are you waiting for? Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines, also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community.
And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on GBB Freeport, New York. Just received a text that the Mets are up 1-0. Home run, Curtis Granderson. Great news. I hope you have your laptop on your lap and you're listening to me and have Joe Buck, Tom Verducci, and Harold Reynolds turned down, which I'm sure is not a bad thing for most of you. I hope you had a great Halloween weekend. Again, the Mets on the brink have to come back. Let's go, Mets. And I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. Well, my next guest played for the Jets from 1977 to 1989, two-time Pro Bowler. He was elected to the Jets Ring of Honor in 2012. I'd like to welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Wesley Walker. Wesley, good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
Great. It's great to have you with us, Wesley.
I appreciate it. I really appreciate it.
You watching the World Series?
Yeah, I will be watching. I just got through watching the Jet game. I'm a little bit depressed.
Yeah, I hear you.
Can cheer me up.
What did you think of that effort from the Jets today?
Well, you know, every year, you know, when you get ready for the season, and I always, anytime anybody asks me, how do you think the Jets are going to do, you know, every team has an opportunity, and injuries play a big factor in it, and week in and week out. Mm-hmm. And the Jets, obviously, with the injury to Fitzpatrick, even Brandon Marshall got dinged up, a couple people in their secondary, and it just was just not a good team effort. And the Jets have been doing pretty well as a team. I really like what Todd Bowles has put together.
Yeah.
But today, defensively, was such a letdown, and they didn't play in all phases of the game. They just didn't play very well.
You're right. So it looked like it's at some points that they didn't show up today.
It's like they didn't show up. And I do not like seeing injuries. I know the coaches touched on the fact that, and I love Fitzpatrick. He's a competitor. He can run, but he's got to learn how to slide. Geno comes yeah. in. He took a couple of shots, and especially down the sideline when he was able to scamper for a few more yards, and he took a shot that he doesn't need to take. And that's how you get injured, and you have to be smart about it. But I was just so disappointed in this with the tackling of the defense. And the Raiders ran the ball well. They passed the ball well. Mm-hmm. And the Jets defensively didn't do anything well. And I wouldn't put this on Geno Smith. I put that on the defense today.
Yeah, I agree. Now, moving to your career, Wesley, you graduated from Carson High School in Carson, California. You were an All-American at the University of California. Talk a little bit about your career at Cal.
Cal Berkeley was a unique school for me. And I tell people, you know, even though I earned a scholarship to play football and I ran track also, I actually chose the university because of its academic situation. They had a good reputation of being a very good school academic-wise. And I've always been self-conscious about my academics. My parents were my role model, so they always taught me the value of an education, and I was very fortunate. I was a good student athlete, and my grades were very good. So when I got recruited, I probably got recruited by every major university in the country, so I had my pick and choice. And I chose the University of California, not only thinking I'd have an opportunity to play, but I was going to get a very good education, and plus it fit my personality. And on a nice day, it's God's country to me. I was just out there doing this summer with my girlfriend and the kids, and we had a ball, and I was able to go back because I got inducted to the Hall of Fame, and I think it was 92 or something, and I was able to show the kids where I went to school and the plaque that's up on the wall, and I just had a great experience just as an athlete. And I certainly had my ups and downs as an athlete, winning, losing, not quite getting there, but I was surrounded by some good football players. Matter of fact, my two quarterbacks that I had were Vince Ferragamo and Steve Barkowski, who went number one in the draft. And I had this guy, Joe Roth, who would probably surpass all their records, and he ended up passing away of cancer his senior year.
Oh, shame.
And so I was just a very good, well-rounded athlete, not only as a football player, but as a student, education-wise, and I couldn't have made a better choice.
Great reasons all, Wesley. Now, you were drafted in 77. You went to the Jets. During that time, Not shockingly for the Jets, they were lean years. How did you feel about becoming a Jet?
I was very excited about it. One big disappointment for me was my senior year, and that's why the education is so, so important. I got hurt my senior year, and I didn't know if I'd be able to play again, and I had a very serious knee injury, so that scared a lot of scouts. And I remember the Jets had said that I was going to be their number one draft choice until I hurt my knee. And as the draft started, I'm not getting the early calls, being that number one draft choice. I was so disappointed. I was getting all the calls from my family and not receiving any calls from the NFL. And finally, I get a call from New Orleans saying they're starting the second round. We were going to draft you. And I was excited about that because there was a guy by the name of Chuck Muncy, who I went to school with at Cal, who had gotten drafted the year before by New Orleans. So I was excited to go out there to be with one of my teammates. And then I get the call, and it was the New York Jets. And I was excited about that because when you come to New York, there's nothing like it. I'm still enjoying things that I haven't been able to do when I first got to New York because there's so much excitement, so many things to do. The only big factor that I had or any problem is just the weather. But I'm a Long Islander. I love Long Island. Never wanted to leave. Matter of fact, one of my teammates is here that used to live down the street, Freeman McNeil.
Uh-huh.
And he's still here also. And, you know, we stay in touch through the Jets and the things that we do appearance-wise. So I get a chance to see a lot of the guys. It's always great to see. And one of the great things about being a professional athlete, you meet such a great group of guys and you have this camaraderie together. And one of the things I do miss is that you develop these friendships, but then when it's all over, people go their separate ways. Some guys you don't even hear from. I have one guy that was an all-time pro bowler, Marvin Powell, who was a big offensive tackle who got drafted in the first round, and it was me and him, the first and second round. He was my best man. He was one of my best friends. We lived together, and I have no idea where he is to this day, and he should be in the Ring of Honor. But hopefully they'll run him down. But those are the kind of relationships you miss when you've been together for so long. But some of the guys still get together, and the Jets are trying to reach out to more of the alum to bring them together. And I'm looking forward to this Ring of Honor. They're honoring Emerson Boozer and Matt Snell.
Right.
But they're trying to get all the guys to come back, even if you paid, you know, a couple of months or 13 years, they want you to come back. So it's going to be a nice feeling to see some of the guys you hadn't seen in a long time, that they fly in, they put you up in the hotel, and you know, you have dinners together and you get a chance to socialize with a lot of people. And even guys that you never played with or guys that you've heard about. You know, I never played with Joe Namath, and you get the chance to smooth and talk, and it's like you've known them for years, even though you didn't play with them, you know?
Right, exactly. Certainly a good thing that the Jets are doing in keeping their alumni under their auspices. Now, when you get to the Jets in the late 70s, Wesley, as I said, kind of lean years, but then they turned the corner in the 80s. They almost got to the Super Bowl then. When did you see that things were beginning to turn around for the Jets?
Well, I've always, you know, even from day one, even though we didn't have much success, I was always confident in our ability. I always thought we, you know, as athletes, we could play with anybody, and we certainly had some great athletes. I mean, I look at Joe Glecko, could play with any, Mark Gastineau, Al Toon. I mean, I could, guys that didn't have a name, like we had this defensive back, Bobby Jackson.
Oh, yeah, Jackson, I remember
who,
Bobby.
Who's the best defensive backs you ever played with? I said, I go against Bobby Jackson, guys like Jerry Holmes. They prepared me for what I needed to go against, you know, week in and week out, and I would take them over anybody in the NFL. Kenny O'Brien was very underrated, and I tell people, I never played with Joe Namath. It's not a knock against Joe, but I said I would take Kenny O'Brien over John Elway or Manning or anybody you could put up against. Dan Marino, I used to say that, but he was my guy. But we could play with anybody. You know, and when you play this game, though, as you get older, you don't really realize it when you're a youngster, and you don't know how many times you're going to get a certain opportunity, whether it's injuries or just a time spent. And I think of Dan Marino, who had all those great years and never getting to the Super Bowl. And it's very disheartening when you don't make it there. And I remember in 82 losing to Miami in that mud ball in the rain. and we had to get ready and have to make plans as if we were won the Super Bowl. We won the championship with your families and make these plans. And then when you have all these plans, you're talking to the media and you have this opportunity to go, and then you lose, and then all of a sudden it's all over and it's not there anymore. And that's very disheartening as an athlete. And you think about the time you put in. I played 13 years, and mm-hmm. I had some opportunities. We also, I remember, I think it was in 86, where we went 10-1. I thought we were going to be in the Super Bowl. And
right.
We lost five straight. We had a lot of injuries to a lot of key people, and that was our downfall. And we got into the playoffs, but we lost right away. And never did make it, and then you just don't get the opportunity. So you have to really take advantage of it when you get that opportunity. I think as you get older, you realize that after it's too late, and that's the unfortunate part with this ball game. And like I said, we had guys that could play with anybody, and a lot of these guys don't get the recognition because they didn't go to a Super Bowl or they weren't on TV enough, and they didn't get the accolades, and so you don't get the exposure. And I know that we could play with just about anybody on the planet, but that's unfortunate. But
sure.
We know in our hearts what we brought to the table.
Definitely. We're speaking with Wesley Walker tonight on Sports Talk 1240. So we found out, Wesley, the best quarterback you ever played with was your own Kenny O'Brien. The best defenders were your own defensive
Absolutely.
Backs who
no
you went against
down.
In practice. And let's talk a little bit about the coaches. I mean, you started out with Walt Michaels. Walt had some success. Joe Walton, who had some success. You even had Richie Kotite as your offensive coordinator. Talk a little bit about the guys at the top.
Well, I had a great deal of respect for all my coaches. That's number one. And I know Walt Michaels had drafted me. And a lot of times you don't get to know the coaches until maybe after you retire and you develop a little bit of more of a relationship with them. I remember talking to Walt Michaels during his retirement, and we'd be at the Jet games and making these appearances, and you're talking to him at on another venue, and they're different people, and you find out how knowledgeable they are. But sometimes it doesn't come across when you're being coached by them. They don't feel like they can maintain a relationship or a friendship, and I wish coaches would get out of that habit. And I used mm-hmm. to tell them, why couldn't you be like this when we were, playing? But they feel like they can't be your friend, and I never could understand that. Joe Walton was a guy that motivated me. At one point, I felt like he was in my corner. But by the time he left, he kind of demotivated us as players, where he tried to do too much, and he ran the whole show. Even as head coach, he didn't leave it up to his coordinators to delegate some of the responsibility. He tried to run the whole building, and he changed as a person. I had a guy, Herman Edwards, who was my teammate in college, and
right.
And I had another guy also in college, Paul Hackett, who was a coordinator here, and I was doing TV and radio pre and post game show, and it's like I didn't even know these people. You just mentioned Richie Kotite being my head coach. I remember I had to call 24 hours in advance if I wanted to show up to practice. And I just recently told a reporter where we never really felt quite welcome when we left as an alumni. I played 13 years, and I had access to come because I was doing TV and radio. And I know certain guys would fight with the security guards that didn't know us very well. I remember
Ooh.
Bill Parcells, who was here, who I had a great deal of respect for. His alumni could come back like Carter Blanche in there and had full access, where guys like myself would have to fight to get in, and it was always an uncomfortable situation. At least we never felt welcome. But just recently, with the acquisition of Todd Bowles, he's tried to reach out to all the alumni, and he's trying to bring that back. Unfortunately, I'm here on Long Island, so it's not like I could just go to Florham Park or mm-hmm. to the MetLife Stadium. As if it were Shea Stadium or Hofstra University, and that's
right.
the unfortunate part. But certainly those guys as coaches brought a certain emphasis, a certain intellect to the game. But, it's based on one wins and losses. And when you don't win, your tenure is up. And Walt Michaels felt that, and it's unfortunate we get close to the Super Bowl, and he gets fired the next week after that. but you don't know behind the scenes what the relationship is like. You have coaches who will stab you in the back, and they're looking to try to, I guess, you know, to move up the ladder too. And there's a lot of politics involved. But as a player and as a competitor, you respect the coaches that you're with, and you hope you're going to go to bat for them, and hopefully they're going to go to bat for you. But sometimes those relationships changes, and they don't stay the same. And that's one of the problems I've always had. I always wanted somebody to have confidence in me, somebody that respected you for your ability, and somebody that you can go to. And if you had an opinion about them, you can express that. But a lot of times you can't do that. And some coaches you can do that with, some you don't. But you live and learn, but you try to make do and try to do the best that you can under the situation. But I've always respected all my coaches, whether you agree with certain ones, that's a whole other story. But I did have a coach, Dan Henning, who was a coordinator.
Dan Henning, right.
And he was like best. And when and to me, a coach that brings you to another level, and, you know, they can take you to a certain point and then you get better. And you learn something that makes you even better than what you are. That's a real coach. Dan Henning was able to do that with me. And I credit a lot of his expertise that he provided for me, made me a better receiver. And naturally, he got caught up in the politics. He wanted either more security or more money, just didn't want to do it. Then he went to another team. And it's unfortunate about this NFL. It's a big business. And that's
sure.
It's become more commercial and more of a business. But that's how you have to, you treat it nowadays, too. You have to be smart about it. And as an educator myself, I try to bring that back to the athletes and the guys that are going to come, you know, before and after me also, if you can lend that. Because it's not about the money. It's about taking care of yourself. It's about doing, making the right decisions and try to do something after your career is over. Because a lot of athletes, so once they're done, you know, they get lost.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Very, very good points, Wesley. We got Wesley Walker with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Some of the marquee guys you played with on those good Jets teams, Wesley, the New York Sack Exchange. A lot of folks may not remember those guys. Abdul Salam, Joe Klecko, who should be in the Hall of Fame, is
absolutely
in the Ring of Honor. Mark Gastineau and Marty Lyons, another local guy. Talk a little bit about the Sack Exchange.
Well, I always love those guys. I always love my teammates. And you just mentioned those three guys that are still on Long Island. The only one that's not here is Abdul Salam, and he's having some health issues. I think he had a stroke, and those are the kind of things that you're looking at now long term. And some of these guys that, from a health standpoint, that's what you got to look at down the road. Also with injuries, I've certainly battled with that. But when you mention Marty Lyons, he's still on Long Island, and you don't hear enough of the good things he does for children that are terminally ill for his Marty Lyons Foundation. But
right.
Certainly a great athlete. Joe Klecko, like you said, should be in the Hall of Fame. Maybe one day he will get inducted. There's a lot of politics that goes with that. But he played, you know, every position on that defensive line and did very well at it and made the Pro Bowl. I've never seen somebody so strong, and there's nobody that could defend him one-on-one. And when you have another guy, Mark Gasol, on the other side, it just makes your job just much easier. But a lot of people didn't realize that Abdul Salam would tie up, you know, two and three guys and make it easier for those guys, and they'd be the first to tell you about it. But they were a force to be reckoned with. I used to love watching Gastineau and Joe Klecko rush the passer. And as good as we were, we still didn't quite get there with all that talent. But I wish that we would have got the accolades that we really deserve. Like I said, you mentioned those guys on that line. They were the best of the best. But, you know, when you look at the long term, the Hall of Fame, and that's how people judge you, you know, I don't know if other teams or other players or people around the league would look at them the same way as they do some of these Hall of Famers that are in the Hall of Fame now.
Exactly. Now, with the changes in the offensive rules today, Wesley, would you enjoy being a wide receiver in today's game?
I enjoyed it either way. You know,
okay.
Even when they – could bump you at the line of scrimmage and one-on-one, because if they miss you, it's all over for the defensive backs. It's a very difficult kind of defend a good wide receiver that can run routes. And I don't care if you can't touch you or you can touch you. You know, you're a competitor. Certainly, it makes it a lot easier, the things that they're doing now. And certainly the game has changed. But when it comes down to it, it's blocking, tackling, whether you're a receiver, you have to learn how to catch the ball, and you have to be able to run routes, and you have to be smart about it and know your job. And that's what we did, no matter what rule changes they are. But certainly, being the athlete that I was, you know, I would think I would have been able to thrive in this situation. But it didn't really matter to me. I would welcome the rules the way they were when I first got there. Or if not, I always say, you know, people couldn't cover me. You'd have to have two or three guys. And sometimes right. They couldn't even do it then. You know,
exactly,
but that's the kind
yeah.
of competitor that you are. And I would never sell myself short, but I was never intimidated by anyone. And you have guys certainly you respect. I respected all my opponents, but I never went into a game that saying that, you know, I couldn't beat somebody, you know. And right. I was always very confident. And it's about the team. And if Wesley Walker is going to have success, you know, my guys around me have to have success. Otherwise, I wouldn't be successful. And that's what football is all about. It's a team game, not just one guy.
Perfect. Now, we had some great memories with that Jack Ball Club, as we said. Unfortunately, one of them is that Mud Bowl with that guy, A.J. Dewey, who's a nightmare to all of us Jet fans.
Oh, yeah.
And it is one of the highlights for you, Wesley, that game, that shootout with the Miami Dolphins with Kenny O'Brien?
Absolutely. There's probably not a day that goes by, and especially when I'm doing these appearances. I was just at the MetLife Stadium the other day, and there's always going to be at least one person that's going to bring that game up, and I would like to think it was a great team game, but defensively you'd have to wonder what happened to both defenses the way we were going up and down the field.
Yeah.
Where was the defense, you know? But like I said, I love Kenny O'Brien, and he was always a competitor. He outdueled Dan Marino. We always had these big battles going on. But I just remember making the catch to tie the game with no tang left right over the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I still think about that catch. Like, how did I do that? How did that happen? It was like a dream. And lo and behold, you know, we go on to win the game in overtime with the catch, too. But a lot of people don't know that day I was so disappointed. I was angry at Joe Walton. He wasn't really even using me. I think in the – I probably caught my first touchdown, and it was towards the end of the second quarter. And I remember telling my backup, Kurt Zone, I should rest my groin because I had a slight pull in my groin. And I strained my groin that week, and I actually didn't know if I was going to be able to go that game. And, you know, we rested it a couple of days and stuff, but I was really worried about that because when you have these games and pulls and stuff, it could lead to a bigger and longer lasting thing. So I was always concerned with that. And I just felt at the time, if Joe wasn't going to use me, I might as well just rest my groin. And I remember we finally ran this one play I used to love, and this play action pass, and it was wide open. We get one touchdown. And then we're begging Joe Walton to just go for this this deep pass, which is where I run this fade route toward the right before the half. And Miami, actually, they were in the right coverage, but Kenny was able to get it in between two defenders, and I broke a tackle and scored, and that's got things going. But also during that game, I think about, you know, everybody says you're always like this perfectionist. like after a game, I always could think of what could I have done better. And I remember fumbling that game and thinking, I know Miami recovered. And they scored, and I thought I had lost the game. But I think about I could have made that catch, and I would have been over 200-something yards. But as it stood, you know, I was able to make the catch on the with no time left, and that was a credit to Kenny O'Brien because I was on the sidelines at the time. And this is a play that we've worked on over the years if we get the right situation. But they didn't have the right personnel in at the time, and Kurt Zone happened to be in. And I remember being on the sidelines, and he's talking. Kenny's talking to Joe Walton. He says, "Wesley, get in there," you know. And that's the confidence he had in me.
Uh-huh.
We stick it in, even although they were in the right coverage. We somehow got it in to tie the game up, and naturally, they called my number on the last play on the overtime win. And I was able to get behind Langford and scored again, and it was a game that I will never forget. And you know, and I've had several, but that's one of them I will not forget.
Sure,
and the public
none
won't
of us will either.
Fans
yeah,
will never. Yeah,
exactly.
I love the fans. They will never let me forget that one.
Definitely. Now, in the few minutes we have left, Wesley, I just wanted to ask you about something that's probably personal to you. The NFL and Goodell, Commissioner Goodell, do they do enough to take care of the alumni? We've had Conrad Doebler on. We've had Joe DeLamalier from the Hall of Fame.
I'm so disappointed. And don't get me wrong, Roger Goodell is a friend of mine. He worked for the Jets as an intern where I first got to know him. And I thought things were going to be different and things were going to change. But if you know, if you watch that documentary, The League of Denial, and there's a spot where the Congress is asking him questions and he really wouldn't answer the question.
Right.
They don't want to answer any question having to do with the CT, with the concussions. Insurance-wise, there's no long-term care. They try to act like they're doing something, but everybody's been turned down. Anything that you really try to submit, disability-wise, there's always a big fight. I hope that one day things will change in that area, but I don't think so. It's big business. There's a lot of guys that are hurting, and I've had more surgeries after my career than I did when I was playing. And there have been times where, you know, I've been in that light where you're depressed and you're taking pain medication, and that my highlight of my day would be to take my two pain killers in the morning and take a shower and get back in bed, not leave my room for months at a time, you know?
Yeah.
And I've had a major neck operation fusion. I've had a major back fusion, and then couple with a couple other surgery, Achilles, the shoulders, and things that have happened over the years from playing football, and not even counting what may be happening with your brain. And there's a lot of guys that you don't know about, and some of my teammates are having some really, really tough times. But when you make these submissions and then they turn you down and you got to fight for every little thing, and I remember fighting for a little $600 a month workman's compensation, and I had to subpoena my records from the Jets, and after playing 13 years, and you don't get the respect. And I remember arguing with the president, saying I was in it for the money, but yet they wanted me to sign a waiver. And here I have this serious neck condition. I could take a chance on being paralyzed, and they just didn't care about that, you know. And to this day, I look at what I've done and the time you put in, and there's no way I would do this if, knowing the way I feel right now. I would not do this again, you know, but that's just what
sure.
you learn over the years. But hopefully we'll get better, and I hope one day the NFL and the NFL Players Association will create some type of long-term or some kind of health care that the players can buy into for their health.
I hope so, too, Wesley. Well, it's been a real pleasure having you with us tonight. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your Sunday night to be with us.
I appreciate it. It's good being with you. You can call me anytime. Thank you.
Will do. Have a good night, Wesley. Wesley Walker, folks.
Get back to the Mets.
Will do. Yeah.
All righty.
Let's go, Mets. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, John Matlack and Wesley Walker, and you for joining us. Stay tuned for Hour 2 on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you Sunday, November 29th, after a few weeks off. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
Views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.